equipment to recording at the solar farm. To learn more, visit aboutamazon.co.uk/sustainability.
Hello and welcome back to Immigrantly. I am your host, Nadia Khan. And my voice is back somewhat. It is getting better. I hope you guys enjoyed the rerun of one of our episodes last week. My voice was so bad. I promise I tried, but I could not record another episode. I recorded Hannah Baba's, which was a great conversation, but I could not do that to my vocal cords again. Just a reminder, those of you who have subscribed to Immigrantly channel, Immigrantly Uninterrupted on Apple Podcasts, thank you, thank you, thank you. Those who haven't, for whatever reason, please do consider subscribing monthly or yearly. It's $3.99 a month. $34.99 a year. You will get ad-free content and you'll promote something which is so incredible. Again, thank you for being with me in this space. And now to today's episode. Those of you who know me know that I listen to true crime podcasts more often than I would like to admit. And every time, I find myself sitting with a familiar discomfort. So why are we so drawn to someone else's tragedy? Is it empathy? A need for justice? Or is it something we don't quite know how to name? Those are some of the questions that I struggle with every time I play a true crime podcast. So when I was approached to interview Ahn Soon Choi, I didn't hesitate. Ahn is an immigration historian, a professor. Her new book, LA Coroner Thomas Noguchi and Death in Hollywood, really explores the life of Dr. Thomas Noguchi, a Japanese immigrant who became Los Angeles County's chief medical examiner, coroner, basically, from 1967 to 1982. Now, you may know him as the coroner to the stars, the man behind some of the most infamous autopsies in American history, Marilyn Monroe, Robert F. Kennedy, Natalie Wood. But you know what? This book isn't just about high-profile deaths. It's a story about race, power, politics, and what it really means to be an outsider in a system that constantly questions your place in it. Ahn's award-winning essay on the Japanese American Citizens League and the politics surrounding the Noguchi case laid the groundwork for this powerful, layered biography. This conversation gave me so much to think about. Not just how we die, yeah, that is part of this conversation, but also how we live and who gets to tell the story. So without further ado, let's dive right in. Hi, Ahn. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I am good. I am really excited to talk about something that I've never talked about. Despite being a true crime junkie, I had never heard of Dr. Thomas Noguchi, never heard of the book, not even his claim to fame, which is him being coronated to the stars. So I'm really excited to dive in. But we'll start with this question about obsession, right? Sometimes we start to obsess with stories, personalities. What was the rabbit hole moment in your research, the one detail that made you think, I have to tell this story?
I think for me, the detail was that Thomas Noguchi, in his time in the late 60s and throughout the 70s and early 80s, was well known. He routinely graced the front page of the LA Times. He was a local celebrity himself. And then, curiously, he just disappears. The fact that he's so prominent and then all of a sudden nobody knows about him was the one thing that really intrigued me. And to find out what happened. And what I think is very interesting is that, you know, I knew about Thomas Noguchi because I too am a true crime buff. And so he's always been on the edges of all these cases. And I think what was fascinating to me was that indeed, right, he actually played a much more significant role in these cases than most contemporary accounts sort of lay out. But the fact that he is so involved, yet is somehow completely erased from the narrative, was the thing that I find really fascinating. And oftentimes, this is what happens. Oftentimes, the immigrant participation in famous events, in famous discoveries, oftentimes are completely effaced. And this is one really good example of that.
Absolutely. And given his personality, it seems like he also maintained independence of his office. He was very particular about how he dealt with his cases, how he presented them, sometimes at the expense of what people's expectations were of him. So he was very committed to the science itself. And what's also fascinating to me is that at the time he was conducting these autopsies, there was change happening in forensic science. So forensic science itself was taking off. And can you talk a little bit about how that really cultivated his personality and intrigue around death more than life?
What really changes in the post-war period, so after 1945, is that you have a bunch of things that sort of come into alignment in this particular moment. So it is a combination of the way celebrity changes, the rise of forensic science, and then also just in general, how death investigation changes after World War II. And what you see, particularly with Thomas Noguchi, is that he brings the coroner's office out of the shadows, and he transforms the role of the coroner medical examiner in a way that no other person had done. And I don't think anyone, even now, there's nobody like Thomas Noguchi. And so what he does is he stakes out his independence, which is based and rooted in forensic science. So he does that. But he also becomes a celebrity in his own right. And I think that can only happen, well, in Los Angeles, but in this particular cultural moment. And it all comes at a moment where people in general want to know more. So prior, if I had to put a timeline on it, I think earlier in the 20th century, you know, people were, of course, obsessed with celebrity, just like the way people are obsessed with celebrity now. But I think what happens is that people want to know more. It's just not enough to know about the celebrity that you follow, you know, their day-to-day activities. People want to know everything, even the circumstance of their death. And so there is this increased fascination with death.
And you mentioned at the time, the definition of celebrity was changing. How so?
There's very much particularly in Los Angeles, celebrities are movie stars. But the fact that people increasingly in the post-war period, you could become a celebrity just by sometimes being celebrity adjacent. And we certainly see that now, right? Where we have, you know, people who are followers of a celebrity become a celebrity in their own right. And I really don't think any of this could have been possible without sort of these changes in the way that we understand celebrity. And sometimes it's in the very Andy Warhol sense of people's 15 minutes of fame. Sometimes it's more enduring because Thomas Noguchi becomes, you know, famous for being cornered to the stars.
And that is celebrity adjacent, right?
But he parlays it into real celebrity because he intuitively understands how the media works. And at a time when coroners and medical examiners were not sort of, you know, media facing, he understood the power and the drama of a press conference. He understood how, in the way when he was interviewed, to create a soundbite. And he also, you know, was at the kind of forefront, particularly because this is when TV sort of, you know, emerges from just kind of showing children's shows and things like that, where it becomes as a vehicle for celebrity news and it becomes increasingly more important. And he understands how live television is so critical in terms of media and celebrity representation. And if you just watch some of the interviews he does, it's natural to him in a way that it wasn't for others. Questions unanswered.
First, the facts as Noguchi presented them.
Miss Wood, it appears, based on our investigation, shortly after midnight of their Sunday morning, she apparently attempted to get on to the dinghy, slipped and fell in the water, unable to return to the dinghy or the boat.
In what ways do you think his understanding of how to leverage celebrity status benefited him or presented challenges for him?
Celebrity can be a double-edged sword. And when things are going well for Thomas Noguchi, what it also did was that it solidified his power as the coroner of Los Angeles County. It also kept, and this was really important to him, was that he believed that the investigations that he did in unexplained deaths, et cetera, had to serve the living. And that was the most important job of the coroner's office, that, right, it's this juxtaposition, right? The coroner's office, you know, deals with the dead. But he insisted it had to be in the service of the living.
How so?
For example, and then this is where also media becomes a problem for him, too. So he was quite vocal, for example, with the deaths, particularly of like William Holden and Natalie Wood, where he identified that alcohol consumption, that he believed that this contributed to their untimely deaths.
Noguchi said there was no evidence of foul play. He did indicate, however, the tests revealed Miss Wood was technically drunk, but continually referred to Wood's condition as slightly inebriated. He nevertheless admitted that alcohol might have been one reason why the actress was rendered unconscious.
And I think he was very much, you know, prescient about this belief, because now we know, right, there are all these reports that have come out that, you know, any amount of alcohol is bad for you, you know, it's terrible. But he knew from his forensic work and his research as a scientist that alcohol wasn't good, in the sense that, you know, excessive drinking could cloud your judgment, it could contribute to death. And so he wanted the public to know about this. And this is the 70s and the 80s where alcohol, you could advertise it in magazines and on television. There aren't the same kind of prohibitions that we see, but he thought this was a public health issue. But then the Screen Actors Guild is protesting against him. after Natalie Wood's death, he had mentioned, you know, her drinking in a news a press conference because he wanted people to know, right, the dangers of this. And then so Frank Sinatra is outraged. And this is one of the most interesting things I found during my archival work. I found a handwritten letter by Frank Sinatra on this heavyweight embossed stationery with his name on the top, where he's completely outraged because he felt that Thomas Noguchi had violated the privacy of Natalie Wood. When all this becomes public, this works against Noguchi.
There's so much to unpack in this, but I will bring in added layer of his immigrant identity, right? He's Japanese American. All this is happening in the 60s and the 70s, a couple of decades after World War II. There's still racism. I mean, racism exists in 2025, and we are talking about 1967 onwards. How do you think his identity played a role in how he was targeted or isolated in how he conducted his work?
So Thomas Noguchi was part of the post-war Japanese migration called the Shin-Issei. So he was from Japan. He came to the U.S. in the 1950s. And in many ways, part of the way, you know, I'm not sure isolation is the right word, but his kind of dislocation is because he doesn't have the same experiences as other Japanese Americans in the U.S. have, the vast majority who were incarcerated in concentration camps during the war. He comes from Japan with a very different experience. And also, what's very puzzling for him to navigate is that particularly whites in Los Angeles just view him as Japanese American. And the anti-Japanese sentiment is always sort of lurking in Los Angeles, and it's particularly acute in the 50s and 60s. And so oftentimes, like, he, I think, undergoes a process where he becomes racialized and he begins to understand, like, at first, like, it's puzzling. He's like, you know, I don't know why this is happening. I think it made a really big difference that he was married to a Japanese American woman who was incarcerated during the war. And when he was battling to be appointed as the coroner the first time, he's like, oh no, this can't be racist. He's like, what is going on here? And his wife comes out and says, absolutely, this is racist, and this is the double standard. And so what you steadily see as he moves through his career is a greater understanding of this and where he fits in. But then he also doesn't fit in to Japanese American sort of expectations and the community here, because oftentimes, particularly his chasing of the limelight, you know, Japanese American communities who, especially and rightfully so after the war, wanted to rebuild their lives and sort of, you know, they didn't want like undue attention. Oftentimes they felt that he did not know his place. And so he's a person that caught between his own community feeling that, you know, he behaved in unseemly ways, and then the larger dominant society also felt that he did not know his place.
What does that mean?
So when, for example, when he is going after the first job, right, like to become the coroner, you know, oftentimes, particularly like, and these institutions were dominated by particularly white men, the County Medical Association, the medical school at USC and UCLA, they come out and basically say that Thomas Noguchi is unacceptable to be chief coroner for any number of reasons. A lot of it is couched in racist language. But when you look at the sum total of the language and the rhetoric, you can see that he is a person, while there willing to accept him as a junior coroner or an assistant coroner within the county system, he can't have the top job. So he's someone who did not know his place. And then at the same time, you know, Japanese Americans, many of them felt, you know, why is he kicking up such a fuss about this? Why is this turning into a media spectacle? It's a really complicated set of political identities that exist under the umbrella of Japanese Americans. But particularly, he really, some of what they perceived to be his behavior sort of did not align with what the community thought was appropriate.
But then he plowed through. How do you think he did that?
Well, part of the thing, and I think this is just a wonderful testament to his long career in the county, he points out to the civil service system. Because of the way the civil service system is structured, he scored in the top three of the civil service exam. And then ultimately, the civil service system would become unionized. And right, so these things protected him. And so whether the county wanted to interview him or not, the system prevailed and the system worked. And what's very interesting is that he gets all sorts of support that is sort of cross-racial. So the Black community, the Mexican-American community, and also a significant number of county employees who are white support him because they understand. And so at least for what's very interesting for the county folks who support him is they don't really come out and say, oh, this is racist and this is why we can't. They're like, no, this undermines the civil service system. And so it's this interesting kind of alliance of convenience that comes together. And then, but what's very interesting is both Mexican Americans and African Americans will support Noguchi because all these communities understand, just like Japanese Americans, that in the post-war period, civil service jobs are a guaranteed pathway to the middle class. And they want to make sure that is protected and they have more opportunities within the system. And so they were very sensitive to any possibility of particularly these avenues being closed off.
That makes a lot of sense, especially when people are coming together as a collective to ensure that their rights are protected and they have access to resources and to systems and structures that are being kept away from them. You know, Anne, you've talked about Thomas Noguchi being very connected to his work, right? He never called people corpses. He would not call them that. He had that human connection even with the dead. But I was thinking that there is something really lonely about the work of interpreting death. Do you think Noguchi ever felt haunted by the bodies, the headlines, the scrutiny? I keep thinking it must be a very lonely place to be in.
I think he did. He wrote a memoir and sort of about his cases in a book in the 1980s he wrote. And that's how I actually learned about Thomas Noguchi, because I had found this memoir. It's called Coroner. And I found it in the dollar bin at the Strand bookstore, this gigantic bookstore in New York City that just put out these bins outside for people to buy books. And I had picked up because I was like, this guy is Japanese American. I was like, I didn't know he had published a book. And I had read the book and it stayed with me for a really long time. And in the book, if you think about being alone as a metaphor, right? When you look in his writing, even though, like, I know logistically there are other people in the room, there's an assistant, sometimes, you know, someone from the district attorney's office is in the coroner's suite. But the way he writes about it, the perspective is that he is completely by himself. And I think he felt that way about a lot of things. And I think what he was very struck by that I found, like, there are two things that he talks about publicly. He talks about when he autopsied Marilyn Monroe.
One silver dollar.
And I think that really struck home for him, not only because there was so much mystique around Marilyn. She was the most beautiful woman in the world. She was the same age as him. And the idea, she was so vital, and right, so it did have an impact. And then he also talks about his autopsy about Robert Kennedy. When he's doing this autopsy, you know, there are like dozens of people in the room as witnesses. There are people from Washington, D.C., right? Like, but he talks about this moment where he covers the face of Senator Kennedy, because he talked about, you know, everything that Kennedy represented in the 60s. But you always got the sense that it was such a solitary experience for him.
And wasted and lost in the dust of time.
And I do think he, at times, he was very fortunate that he had such support from his wife. He did have a circle of very, you know, I think, supporters and friends. But I think a lot of his work was really lonely, because oftentimes also he would be the first person to stake out a position in a field. And everyone's like, oh, no, that wouldn't work. But he would insist. And then it would turn up, for example, I just watched something. I can't remember what. It was just it was some kind of crime show, like investigating. And immediately they're like, you know, they find a body that's really, right, decomposed. They're like, okay, we have to go do dental records and we'll do. You know, no one did that routinely before Thomas Noguchi. Like, he is the one that institutionalizes that as part of a death investigation. This is one way, because he understood forensic dentistry, and he had, you know, he found someone who did that work, and he came up with this protocol after it was either a plane or a helicopter crash that had happened in Los Angeles, and they couldn't identify the bodies. And so, and then people are like, oh, you, like, this is not a reliable way, but now it's a standard protocol now. And there are so many of those kinds of things that Thomas Noguchi staked out in his work as the coroner, that people at the time, oh, there's no way that can work, right? And I think that's a really, like, as someone who was oftentimes a visionary, that's a very lonely place to be. And then I think back to this point where he wasn't always accepted within the Japanese American community. Whites didn't always. And so I think he lived in this kind of liminal space. And I think that is an inherently lonely place, but also an inherent sort of place that immigrants occupy. It's really lonely to be an immigrant.
It is lonely, and it's confusing at times, right? The idea of belonging itself, and whether we create it or is it intrinsic to who we are, right? I feel like we create it brick by brick by being who we are. And his story is a testament to how he made that space for himself. I do want to talk about something else that you mentioned. You've said that he is the OG influencer. We've talked about how he liked fame and limelight, and there was a part of him that would sensationalize things. He was a bit dramatic in some ways. And I wonder if he operated today in the era of Reddit conspiracies, TikTok, and true crime influences. How do you think he would be perceived? Like, would he go viral on TikTok or just simply get canceled?
He would be at the top of his game, because he just had this incredible ability to distill things for media consumption. And on top of that, he also, I consume a lot of different things, right, media-wise. And then there are a lot of, and I'm also an academic. I am specifically a U.S. immigration historian. And so I am incensed when, like, people with no background at all, like no training at all, feel free to talk and analyze. And of course, I want people to think historically. I want people to do those things, but to speak as the expert. And then this influences policy. This influences all sorts of things. The thing about Thomas Noguchi was that all his credentials were in place, right? You know, when he was speaking as the coroner, he was a person who had done thousands of autopsies. He did 2 medical internships. He trained, right? He did all these things. Like, he was also not a person that was just in the autopsy suite in the early part of his career. He was out at death scenes. And so he had experience and educational training that I think on social media today, that would make him very, very different.
You mentioned how you consume true crime stories a lot. I do that too. And in my intro, I talked about how sometimes I pause and think as to why. I'm not going to lie, I feel embarrassed at times. I do feel like I have this moral dilemma that I go through every time I click on a true crime murder mystery podcast, because I'm like, why am I so fascinated by someone's death? And you and I have talked about Thomas Noguchi, but I want to expand this conversation and make it about society as a whole. Why do you think the society is so enamored by tragedy, someone else's death? And I'm not even talking about celebrity deaths. I'm talking about ordinary people dying, brutal murders, horrific deaths. What does it tell us about the society?
Well, this is something that I've also thought about. And I think there are a bunch of things here. I think one is that people have always been obsessed with death, right? This is not unusual or different in our time. And it is about one's own individual mortality. And I think oftentimes we turn to true crime, not even for celebrity's sake, but we want to use it as a blueprint of what not to do. Okay, so this person was abducted on this highway at 3 a.m. in the morning. Okay, so I can't go, and I need to tell all my friends we can't drive around at 3 a.m. and stop at rest stops in upstate New York. It's so dangerous, right? So, like, I think particularly when, and I think this is a very anxious moment for people in general, and I think when culturally, there's a lot of anxiety because either the political system, the economy, any number of things, then we search for concrete things that we think as individuals, right? That, okay, well, I'm not going to get abducted by a serial killer. Immigrants are being disappeared on the streets, but I am not going to be taken by a serial killer. I think there's that component. I think the other thing about true crime is the horror of it. I think there's certainly a segment of the population that listens to true crime for titillation, right? And just the horrifying aspects of it. But it also tells us something. The fact that the victims of crimes are so often women and people of color and marginalized folks, that tells us that the world is a really dangerous place for these groups. And I think that's actually really important because that says something about our cultural moment. And so it is not surprising to me then people gravitate toward true crime as a way to understand something about the world we live in. And then I think also, particularly the forensic side of true crime, I think it's spawned this really interesting sort of the promise and peril of technology, like the internet. But the fact there are so many people who are involved in true crime that have actually been able to solve these crimes because of technology and access to people and connections. So I think there is a part of people who consume true crime that allows them to take action. I don't think people should just passively consume things all the time. It has to lead to some kind of change and action. But more importantly, what if it gives you empathy for other people? And I think that's why these kinds of narratives are also very important, because, you know, some of the things I've listened to are so gut-wrenching. But then, you know, I hear, right, a story about someone very, very different from me, but they have lost their mother. They have lost their child. Like, these are lost things that I can understand. And so that prompts empathy and, right, and for me in that moment, a greater understanding that even though we are two very different people across time and space, that we do have commonality. And if true crime can do that, I think that's actually quite powerful.
But how do we parse out commodification versus honoring victims, creating that sense of empathy, understanding somebody else's plight, learning from it? Because a lot of times I feel the true crime space or genre has been commodified, right? It's like 8-episode series that we consume in a day or 2 days. And that's where I guess I feel guilty that I am partaking in something that has been so commercialized. But you're right. I never thought of all the good things that you brought up. Hopefully next time I consume any true crime podcast, I'll keep all of that in mind.
I remember when Serial first came out, everybody was talking about it. Everybody, like my friends, you know, my sister, right? Like everyone was talking about it and had, you know, feelings and, you know, so if it is part of a larger conversation, I think you can sort of, it doesn't completely eliminate the commercialization and all those things. But if you're really kind of talking about it, to think about Islamophobia, if you think about, you know, what immigrant life in a city looks like, if you use it to be reflected, have conversations, I think that's very different.
And I want to go back to Thomas Noguchi writing this book about a man who interpreted death to teach us all about life. What do you think people should take away from it? What is the lesson here?
I think the lesson here is, in many ways, it's a very familiar immigrant story in the sense that he overcomes all sorts of obstacles to achieve success. And I can really appreciate that. But I think the other part of it is that part of what I wanted to kind of expose is that oftentimes we're very generic about the obstacles that immigrants overcome, right? Like it's just like we do this stuff and, you know, we overcome it and then we're fine at the end. But I think it's important to understand these obstacles oftentimes are systemic and built into the system, right, that work against immigrants. They are interpersonal. Sometimes they come from the individuals you perceive as your own people. They come from within your community. And so I really wanted to reveal how complex it was for him to overcome these things. So that's part of it. And then the other part, I think, is that lots of stories, when you unpack them, and so these are very stories that have been told, you know, Marilyn Monroe, all these things have been told. But if you dig just a little deeper, you can see how lots of what we consider to be mainstream stories really intersect with immigrant experience. and the full narrative and allowing the cultural space for immigrant stories to be recognized, I think, is the other part of this, you know, why I think people should walk away with.
You know, Anne, this is such an important point. Really talking about immigrant narratives as mainstream stories. I feel like as immigrants, we have internal struggles around whether our stories matter, whether we have the permission to tell certain stories. Should we limit ourselves to particular stories? And a lot of times we are used as props for a particular kind of a story. Story around immigration, story around politics and policy. But there's so much more to immigrant identity and our lived experiences. It's so important to say, hey, it's humans living their lives. The only difference between us and them is either the time we stepped into this country or that we weren't born here. That's it.
I think the really fascinating thing, right, about immigrant identity in a nation of immigrants is how quickly immigrant identity disappears for some people and not for others.
Do you think for Noguchi it did, or did he hold on to it?
I think by virtue of being born in Japan, he hung on to it. And he used, I think oftentimes he used it strategically too. Like one thing that I was just endlessly entertained by is like before he is fired and demoted at the end of his career with the county. Well, he continues to work for the county, but in the early 80s, is that he's experiencing all this criticism. The LA Times has launched an investigation into the office. You know, everyone is like, the scrutiny is on him. And then he invites people to a lunch in the coroner's suite, like so in his office where he has a kitchen. He had a kitchen installed and he prepares a traditional Japanese meal. Like he uses it in ways that are subversive. It is very, very interesting to me. And I think, you know, he maintains his ties with Japan. The thing I really enjoyed about doing research, he has this great interview in when he retires after 30 years with the county. And he just says he wouldn't change a single minute of it, even though it was so contentious and difficult. But what I think is interesting is like in immigrant narratives, Thomas Noguchi never appears.
Yeah, I had not heard of him. It's so crazy. And we started with you mentioning that he disappeared all of a sudden. We'll end it with why.
Initially, he's fired, but then he's demoted. He, in the 80s, he orchestrates, he tries to get his position back. He's not successful. He doesn't have the same sort of support that he did in the 60s. And then, you know, because he makes a lot of missteps. Coroner's office is in disarray, but that's not just Thomas Noguchi. That's also a steady underfunding of the office for decades. And the person who would be appointed after him encounters the exact same issues. But he leaves, and then he is assigned as a pathologist, a staff pathologist at County USC Hospital. And what's very interesting about him is like, yes, this is absolutely a setback, right? He had the top position in the county. Now he's a staff pathologist. He eventually becomes the chief pathologist. He always has the capacity and something inside of him to reinvent himself. And then so what he does is that he returns to research full time. He teaches. I think those things served his better nature. And so there are generations of forensic pathologists who have been trained by Thomas Noguchi, like throughout Los Angeles and throughout the U.S. And I think it served his better nature. And this process of reinvention is absolutely central to, you know, an immigrant narrative. And what more American, right? That no matter what, right, he can reinvent himself.
Thank you. you were to define the United States of America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
I think a word or sentence, complicated. Complicated. In this particular moment, it's pretty much the only word that I can come up with, and maybe also the other word, amnesia. Like, for an immigrant nation to forget their immigrant roots and to understand that aside from indigenous folks, we are all immigrants.
I love the word amnesia. And where can people find this book?
This book is available at all your major booksellers. I buy my books from bookshop.org if I have to buy them online. But otherwise, I would encourage people to go to your local bookstore. Octavia Bookshelf in Pasadena is a place where I love to buy books and support a Black woman-owned business. So that's a terrific place. And then if you're interested, you can also find me at LA True Crime on Instagram. Then I do some smaller true crime stories there, and then plus my own work. But I loved chatting with you today. This was so much fun.
Thank you, Anne. This was wonderful. So Anne and I talked post-interview as well. And guys, we are serious about starting a podcast club. I don't know if there is one out there, but how can we not have that for people who consume podcasts and listening to them? You know, we could just pick a podcast, maybe a few, and then just talk about them. Learn something new from those podcasts. Exchange ideas and thoughts. Oh my gosh, I am already so excited. So if you're interested, DM us at Immigrantly Pods on Instagram. We'll come up with something. I'm going to have another conversation with Anne about this, and we will most likely launch something soon. If you liked this episode, don't forget to share it or give it a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It was produced by me, written by me, Sadia Khan. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. The music is done by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week when I have another guest for you. Until then, take care and keep listening to podcasts.